This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome back to Crosswires, the technology variety show, which I think we absolutely need to make our tagline now as well.
Yes.
Where we discuss all sorts of things in tech. This episode is going to be one of those where we look at something cool, but also trying to ask some important questions about our privacy online and how the choice of browser that we use really can impact that more than you may think. So, of course, I'm joined by my beautiful fiancé and co-host, Jay. How are you doing, Jay?
Doing good. I was just trying to open this up in Internet Explorer 6, and I was just having trouble like getting it to work. It wouldn't accept the HTTPS for the Squadcast. So
Don't joke about that. I had a colleague at work today who genuinely said, "Oh, I'm trying this site in Internet Explorer." I'm like, why?
I remember one of my past works, one of their integral systems would only work on IE6. It's like they would have like a copy of it on their server. I'm just like, no.
I think maybe that's something we can talk about, because I'd almost say, without spoiling the rest of the content, I think we are, with a certain browser, we are coming close to being back in the only works with Internet Explorer days.
Oh, yeah. Or at least putting all your DNS through them. That was one thing we learned about that browser.
Yeah. Anyway, let's introduce our guest, because it's a little bit surreal, because our guest is the CEO of a company that makes the browser that we're currently using. Now, if you've been around our live streams, you'll know how much we've been advocating for Vivaldi. And Vivaldi is, I mean, without stealing the rest of the content, is a wonderful Chromium-based browser. But today we're really honoured to be joined by John von Tetzner, who is the CEO of Vivaldi. Now, John, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, this is another one of those seeing someone's post on Mastodon and reaching out. Mastodon, honestly, for me, has actually got us more podcast guests than any other social media we've ever used.
Well, it's really cool. It's like at a podcasting conference I was at, Chris Brogan, who's a mega celebrity, said, "We're all nerds. Just come up and talk to us." And that's really what it seems like.
Yeah, Mastodon is great. That's for sure.
Yes. It definitely has 100% less Elon Musk, which is definitely a good thing.
Yes.
Anyway, John, do you want to tell people a little bit about yourself, maybe a little bit about your own journey in tech? Because when we were sort of going through this, you were saying you've been working on your profile, you've been working on browser-based projects and web-based projects, what, since 92?
Yeah. I mean, in 1992, I was still kind of at university. I was working also at Telenor Research, so meaning the Norwegian telecom company. And we came across this thing called the web in 1992. And we set up the first web server in Norway and started to build all kinds of things at the time. And a couple of years later, we started building a browser. So I've been building browsers since 1994.
Wow.
So it's been a while. First Opera, and now Vivaldi. So been doing browsers for a really long time, and been obviously following the kind of progress in browsers and the direction things are going and the like. So it's kind of I feel a bit of ownership to the web as we know it today.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Opera. I know people who still to this day love Opera as a browser, and I used it for a while, definitely back in the earlier days. I was one of those people, you know, when it was very much, and I'm sure you remember this vividly, the Internet Explorer or Netscape Navigator days, when those were your two choices, people proudly displayed on their website, made for Internet Explorer or works with Netscape Navigator. So I guess when we talk about different browsers, John, the reason we talk about, oh, works in Internet Explorer or works in Netscape Navigator as a day, well, or now, you know, the modern version is designed for Google Chrome. Why is that? Isn't a browser just a browser?
Well, I mean, it all starts in the early days with Mosaic. And I think if you look at the specification of the web standards and the like, initially in practice, they were quite vague. So it was then a question of how do you deal with that vagueness? And I think a decision was made by Mosaic, the first kind of popular browser, to be vague and handle errors in a nice way. But that kind of created a randomness because you didn't necessarily know how things were going to be looking, because it was basically, okay, how do they do the fault handling? And that became the norm, and then it followed up with Netscape and then Internet Explorer. In our case, I mean, when we were building Opera, we did things in a different way. We actually made the specification so we created code based on the specification. And from that perspective, we actually had much better standard support than the others. But then it became a question of how do you deal with the errors? And we had to chase the others with being compatible with them. And obviously, you had a situation. I mean, first you had Mosaic, and then you had Netscape, but then came Microsoft with their Embrace, Extend, Extinguish, where the point was to embrace the web standards, extend them with their own kind of differences, and create a situation where they basically ruled the world. So, I mean, we can say that it was a problem from the very beginning. And I think with these early browsers like Mosaic and the like, when the standards started to evolve, they ran into problems. I mean, Mosaic that then kind of became Netscape and actually Explorer. They ran into issues with compatibility, because as soon as you started to rein in on the specification, then you started to have a problem. In addition to that, there's been this long-standing way where the leading vendors in the market, they try to undermine competition by basically creating content that won't work with them. And a lot of the issues, I mean, for us that have been building browsers for the longest time, is actually when our competitors are also maybe the ones that make servers, maybe having important services, and then they do a check on which browser you're using, and then it doesn't work. So it's not because of the standards, it's based on bad practices.
And would I be correct in assuming that we're maybe hinting there to the good old days of IIS, Microsoft's, I don't know if it was it always called IIS, but the Internet Information Services server, where it definitely favored Internet Explorer.
Yeah, I mean, there was one issue. This is all the way back like in 1994. And we had been growing as a company, Opera at the time. And suddenly a number of very crucial websites stopped working. And we were struggling with finding out what the issue was. And then we found out that with IIS version 4, what they did, they included a file that defined the browsers. And if you weren't included, there was a default catch-all. And for the default catch-all, which is where we landed, there was no definition of cookies. So the server wouldn't send you cookies unless you were defined. Now, you can say cookies is something that people talk about privacy today, but if you take away normal cookies from a web server, it just doesn't work. And in this case, servers like the BBC just stopped working. And there really was nothing we could do with it. I mean, practically speaking, I mean, we ended up talking to Microsoft about it, and they ended up fixing it. But it took us 6 months to figure out that the problem wasn't on our side, it was on their side.
Wow. And that's a really good point, because cookies, everyone thinks of cookies. Maybe this is something we can talk about a little bit later, but we all think about cookies in a very negative way now. But they did serve a genuine purpose at the time. I mean, session cookies, you know, am I right for login sessions and, you know, things like that were important in cookies, whereas now I think everyone sees them as tracking and ad-based rather than useful for what they were originally designed for. Is that a fair?
Yeah, I think it's really unfortunate, because, I mean, cookies have their use, and I think storing information for the user has a purpose. And I think the idea, it's kind of funny in a way, so, or sad, depending on how you look at it. So you have the situation where Google is kind of removing support for third-party cookies and instead doing tracking inside the browser and calling it Privacy Sandbox, which sounds like a privacy feature, but it's rather the opposite. So from that perspective, instead of, let's stop using cookies for tracking, it's basically let's stop using cookies and do tracking in a different way, which is not really solving the problem. So there is natural use of cookies, and part of the problems that you run into is cookies are being used even in a way, if you're talking third-party cookies are used for things that are quite okay, and then they're used for bad things. And the sad thing is that because of the bad ways of using third-party cookies, then you have to kind of remove all of them. And then the question is the solution worse than the problem you're trying to solve? And that's what we are about to find out.
Absolutely. No, that's a really good point. So obviously Opera had its own browser engine. Was it, what did you call it? Was it just the Opera? I can't remember what the Opera engines.
It was called, we called it Presto. Initially it was just kind of the Opera engine, and then we gave it a name and we called it Presto. And the special thing about the Opera code is that we wrote it all from scratch.
Wow.
Seriously, we didn't use any libraries. We didn't even use the C++ libraries that you would normally have on the system. We were using C code. We were going lower than that. Which, by the way, allowed us to make the browser available on any platform. Gradually, after we had tuned the code to be memory safe, which I think is unheard of in browsers today. So memory safe and being able to actually make it work on a new platform inside of 2 weeks. So we would get a new hardware silicon and a new platform OS, and we would have it run in 2 weeks. Obviously, then the delivery would take maybe something more like 6 months to have it hardened and optimized for the system. But just to have it run on a new system would take 2 weeks. And a lot of that was we wrote our own memory handling code, our own graphics code, our own PNG code, our own JPEG code, basically everything. So kind of the opposite of where everything else has been moving. And I think what ends up happening then is that instead of a piece of code taking 150 kilobytes, it takes 5 because you're optimizing the code tremendously for its use. So we had a wonderful piece of code. And personally, I believe we had the best kind of browser code out there. But we were also struggling then with those issues that we might be denied access to certain services. And typically that would be somewhat tied to our competitors, typically.
Got you. And of course, when as a computer user, you discover, Opera won't work with my favorite website. Say, going back to your previous example, I can't use Opera for BBC News. Then it drives you to a competitor's browser. And I think there is a certain element, I think, where for the longest time, a lot of people would have just used Internet Explorer because it was baked into the OS and it was there and it worked with everything, because a lot of the web was at that time, at least, IIS. I still think it's, I was listening to I've mentioned this book and many times, Electric Dreams. And it's about how, how the microcomputer revolution, went in the UK. And we were talking about, Sir Tim Berners-Lee. And we were talking about Linus Torvalds as well, I didn't realize, I don't think this was the machine he actually built the Linux kernel on, but he had a Sinclair QL. And it always just amazes me where these great figures of the internet, probably including yourself, have used computers that I've only seen in a museum, which makes me feel really young in a sense, which is good. Anyway.
You're talking about my third computer, the Sinclair QL. It was a great computer. My first computer was a Sinclair ZX81.
Oh, wow. So you had a QL, so you would have had the micro drive.
I did. I loved the QL. It was a fantastic computer for the time. It was really good. Still, I have QLs. I like old computers. I have a few old computers around, including QL and the other Sinclairs and Amigas and Ataris and a lot of fun stuff.
I my first computer, as I said many times on my show, my first computer was an Amiga 600. But I've got somewhere in a flight case over there, I think I've got a 500 waiting to be restored. So
one interesting thing that I was especially the change from dial-up to internet. Because I remember with dial-up, at least in the United States, a lot of us used America Online, which its web browser was based on AOL. So yeah, I believe that was it Netscape as its base for the AOL browser?
I'm not sure about that one, what they use. I mean, it could have been also basically the Mosaic code. I mean, the interesting thing is how you see the browser code evolve over time. Because you had the Mosaic code, and the Mosaic people then went and made Netscape. So in a way, it used to be called Mosaic in the early days also there. But then there was a company called Spyglass that kind of licensed the Mosaic code. And they then in turn licensed it to a lot of different companies, including Microsoft. So Internet Explorer was originally based on the Spyglass Mosaic code, actually more or less unchanged in the first version. So it was only kind of later version of Internet Explorer that had more of Microsoft written code in it. So it's an interesting history when you try to see, okay, how do the different browsers evolve? Where do they come from? Who wrote their own code and who didn't? And things like that. And actually, most didn't write their own code. I mean, that's the uniqueness of almost all the browsers kind of start with, they start with either Mosaic, which is kind of the starting point for Microsoft and for Netscape and the like, or they start with WebKit, which actually started with KHTML, which is from the KDE Foundation, and then or the Presto code, which we built. So there's kind of three code bases from scratch there in a way, truly from scratch.
Yeah. So that leads me to my next question. Where we stand today, to my knowledge, and this is where I really would value your expertise, I am aware of three core web engines, three core browser engines, WebKit, Chromium, and I don't know if they're still calling it Gecko, but Mozilla's engine that they're using. Is Opera, I know obviously you're not part of Opera anymore, are they now Chromium-based, or are they...
Yeah, which is kind of why, I mean, it's one of the reasons why Vivaldi exists, because they threw away all the code that we had written after I left Opera. So they gave up on the Presto project and went over to Chromium, kind of like what Microsoft also did a few years ago with Edge. So from that perspective, you really have most of the vendors are using Chromium. And then you have Apple mostly on WebKit. And Chromium and WebKit are brothers and sisters. It's important to recognize that Chromium is a fork out of WebKit, and a lot of the code is similar. And then you have the Gecko code, which is still around, but obviously with a gradually smaller market share.
Indeed, because Firefox, I mean, you know, I think it's fair to say personal preference in the browser space is really important. And there are people who are diehard Firefox fans. I've done a YouTube video on a really cool feature of Firefox, which actually Vivaldi now has containers, and Apple have started to do containers with their profile stuff. But I don't think anyone's saying that your choice of browser is good or bad, but there are things to consider. And
yes,
I think it's very interesting, isn't it, that Edge in particular is Chromium based, which always makes me laugh when I hear people say, oh, don't use Edge, use Chrome because it's better. Well, it's the same browser engine. I don't quite understand that. Now, Vivaldi, correct me if I'm wrong, is Chromium based, but you've done a lot of work I guess I want to describe it as de-googly.
Well, there's a lot more to it than that. I mean, obviously, when it comes to it, you can compare the browser engine to an engine. And clearly the engine is really, really important. But most of the browsers now are using the same engine. Now, the differences there is obviously, yes, you do things that changes. Are you calling home or stuff like that? Or are you collecting information? Whether that's kind of the topics, the privacy sandbox and all those things, or just other ways of connecting home. And that's something that we remove. But if we only removed things, that wouldn't really be a unique browser. A lot of what we do is kind of what we are adding to the mix. And it's all driven by the basic principle, instead of collecting data on users and utilizing that to make decisions on how you design the product, we have this unique thing. We talk to users. We actually listen to them. We hear what they have to say. And we don't think, okay, just because it's a minority asking for something, that that's kind of a reason not to do it. If a minority is asking for something, yeah, sure, we'll put that. Maybe it won't be the default, but we'll definitely want to listen and adapt to the needs of every single user. And I think that's really, really important. And that's kind of the ethos of what we are trying to do, to adapting to the needs of every single user. And so we put in a lot of features. I mean, it's kind of like you mentioned, kind of tabs and the like. So other browsers, they tend to have one tab bar, and that's kind of how it works. In our case, you can have the tabs on the top left, kind of right bottom. You can hide them. You have then the workspaces, and then you have tab stacks, and you have three different ways of displaying tab stacks. And then you can have them on the left and right. And then you have a window panel, and you may say, hey, why would I need all of that? And then you say, you don't. You choose which one you want to use, and you find the one that works for you, and then you use that. And similar, I mean, kind of how do you go back and forth in history? I mean, I've loved asking that question. It's kind of funny. So some people, they click the back and forward buttons, or they use keyboard shortcuts. I would use single key keyboard shortcuts. Some will use mouse gestures, or right mouse click and selecting a command. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do things. And for us, it's about, okay, you can get it your way. We'll adapt to your needs. You can tune the browser. You can remove buttons. You can add buttons. You can move them around. You can change the themes. You can do whatever you like with the browser. And again, we are not collecting information on what people are doing. So we don't really know what people are using, what they're not using, except they tell us and they say, we love that feature, we hate that feature, whatever. And then we try to adapt to those needs as much as we can.
I mean, a really great example of where I love a feature is the window panels. I think it's the best way. If Jay is hosting our live stream on Twitch, and I'm there, I have a window panel that's got my Twitch chat, and then I've got Video Ninja in the other panel, in the main part, and I can still interact with Twitch chat while I've still got the tab focused for our call. And it's just so powerful. But on the subject of kind of, and you mentioned this, I think this is really good, you said listening to people's voices. We found an issue where it wasn't loading extensions into the window panels, which was breaking. Jay? Better TT?
Better Twitch TV and FrankerFaceZ. So it wasn't loading the ability for me to add pronoun badges to Twitch chat, which is a part of that plugin.
But you went to the community and you found, oh yeah, people have requested it, and it's, you know, it's something that's been looked at. And it was that responsiveness to, oh, yeah, we're looking at this. Not, oh, yeah, we don't think you need that because you're a Twitch streamer. What do you matter? It is that big difference. I really like the way you frame that. That it's that at the end of the day, you know, it's a wonderful line from Tron, isn't it? I fight for the users.
It's so bizarre to me that, like, Chrome. I remember when Chrome started up, it was a very minimalist browser focused on just speed and all that, and it was focused on trying to take down the monopoly of Internet Explorer. I remember, like, all of the stuff, and I remember getting some people in Chrome being like, hey, download this. And now it's taken over in such a way, because, for instance, I was looking at DNS. I run my DNS through Pi-hole, so I can strip out a lot of different, like, ads and different trackers. Finding out that Chrome has a feature to put you onto Google Public DNS, but if you enable it, it'll bypass whatever DNS is set on your network. So, for instance, if you have Pi-hole, it'll bypass that. And on one hand, I see why they're trying to stop people from getting tracked by their ISP, but it's going to Google for Google's ads and services and stuff like that. So it's weird to see a company that used to go by the mantra of don't be evil until they removed it, has now become taken over by what they once were trying to be against.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the early days of Google, and I mean, when they were coming with a search engine, and I mean, it was a massive improvement. I mean, there was kind of some solutions that could compare, but I mean, it was a massive change. And I think the do no evil, I mean, you got the feel, okay, these guys are doing the right thing. And then they went in a very different direction after a while. And it was really sad to say. And I mean, I've tried to talk to them. I mean, I remember when we started to have issues at Opera with kind of Google Docs and the like. And we had, I mean, it was weird because we had a relationship with Google and suddenly they were blocking us. And I talked to all of them about this. I think they got fed up with me. I was talking to Sergey. I was talking to a number of others about this and they said they couldn't do anything about it. And kind of, okay, it doesn't make any sense. We even offered to send them a developer to work with them because we were always treating it as, okay, it has to be something on our side. But the end, what we had to do, we actually wrote code that would change the code from Google on the fly so it wouldn't block us. And I mean, having to do that is kind of crazy. But I mean, we did what we had to do to make important functions work. And we dealt with Google, we dealt with Microsoft, we dealt with Apple. All of them, we had instances like that that were pretty outrageous, I think, and people don't think about those things. But when you're competing with these big guys, they'll do things that you really think they shouldn't do, and definitely not when you have the do no evil mantra in the background.
Absolutely. And the question, because there's so much we want to talk about. I know you added some stuff in Merz. The one thing that sparked me talking to you really excites me in a sense. And I want to ask you both this question. Do you think that as we stand right now in 2024, early 2024, as we're recording this, that we are getting to a point where Google Chrome, forget the other Chromium browsers for now, but Google Chrome is almost becoming the Internet Explorer 6 of a modern web?
I mean, if you ask me, I would say there is a difference. Is it getting to those kind of numbers? Yes, it is. I mean, if you add together all the Chromium-based browsers, it's quite significant. It's still not at the Internet Explorer level, which was like 95%, right? We're not there, but the numbers are high. But there is still a difference because there is a multitude of companies that are using the same code. And I think that still changes things. And I think the standards are more important than they were at the time. I think you don't see that many issues, I think, with compatibility with Mozilla and the like that maybe we were dealing with in the worst case. I mean, it was really terrible at the time of Internet Explorer, partly because Internet Explorer was just so different in doing things. And they it included things like ActiveX and stupid things like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so from that perspective, getting compatibility was more or less impossible, in particular because you also wanted your browser to be cross-platform. I mean, we were definitely focusing on cross-platform support, mobile phones and the like, and having binary compatibility through something like ActiveX that would be running on your PC would be impossible, right? So Microsoft was infecting the web with things like that, and I don't think we don't have a lot of that when it comes to kind of the web where it is today. We do have issues, and I think we need to be wary and look at certain things. I mean, are we going to be forced into dealing with things like the privacy sandbox and topics and the like, which a lot of us have said we don't want that. We don't want to be profiling. Is there going to be a requirement that you kind of answer in a certain way to servers? Again, we fight all of this, and it isn't really a question of whether we are on Chromium or not, because Mozilla will have to deal with it. If they get blocked because they don't kind of do the same as everyone else, that's a situation I remember very well from the Opera days. It doesn't really help that you say, okay, this is stupid. So hopefully we can all together fight this and stop it and ensure that the web stays open. But I don't think it's as bad as it was in the Internet Explorer days. I think it's but is it something to keep an eye on? Definitely. But the idea of kind of everyone just moving to, say, Firefox or something, I don't really see that's going to fix it.
No, it's not, because, you know, first of all, you've got corporate IT to deal with for a start, which is always a challenge. But beyond that, no, as you said, even though, and again, I'll use Vivaldi, even though your core is Chromium, correct me if I'm wrong, you haven't implemented the privacy sandbox. You're not implementing, what have they called it, Jay? Safety, it's not safety DNS, it's what are they calling that feature?
Secure DNS.
Secure DNS. Their own implementation. We've already got, of course, open standards for that, you know, with DNS over HTTPS and I think that's, and DOE as well. But you're not, when you take the Chromium code, the Chromium source code, because it's open source, which it is, I believe. Yep. You can take away the bits.
Yeah, yeah. We take away bits that we don't like, and we put things into options when it makes sense and the like. So we try to find the right balance on everything. But obviously, part of what we are trying to do is to reduce and remove tracking. That's kind of one of the things that we focus on as a company, and clearly connecting to servers for unnecessary things is definitely something we don't want to do.
And I think one of the issues that Internet Explorer definitely had was security flaws. And I don't see as much of those with Chromium, because like Chrome's always trying to at least update its browsers. I will say one of the areas that I think still gets overlooked is the Google web store, because is it Google Chrome web store, but there are so many applications in there that are like Snapchat or FaceTime, so many app extensions in there that to tech nerds might be obvious, but to the average user they might not realize what these extensions are doing. And I think that's a Wild West playground that is definitely a concern of mine for security. But we also have those with all the toolbars and stuff like that you can have for Internet Explorer, so that's hasn't really changed. But I think now a lot of it's just the monopoly is the concerning part. And like whenever I change my web browser away from Chrome, and Chrome's not installed on this computer, but whenever I had done that, Google will pop up, and I go, when I went to Google, now I go to DuckDuckGo, obviously, because it's way better. But when I would go to a Google site, they'd be like, hey, we see you're not using Google Chrome. Download the fastest secure web browser. And I'm like, no.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, hopefully what's happening now is there's something in Europe called the Digital Markets Act. And I really think that has the potential to change the rules a little bit. And we're already seeing that in Europe, you'll be able to do fantastic things like remove Edge. I mean, think about it. You're going to be able to uninstall Edge after Microsoft saying for like 25 years that it's impossible. Now you'll be able to uninstall Edge. They'll not be allowed to nudge you into kind of keeping it, or warn you that installing something else is dangerous, and that you need to update your operating system and follow the Microsoft recommended internet settings, which again all means Edge. So those kind of things is going to be harder, and I think the reality these big companies, they have misused their powers in bad ways, taking away choice. And I mean, part of that, what you mentioned with the app stores and the like, I mean, the app stores are a problem. I think part of the issue is people think that just because things are in the app store, that it's somewhat safe. But there's been plenty of really bad stuff in the app store, and there are applications there that I think are just scam. I mean, there's an example of this I like to mention. There was a friend of mine. It's just an example case. So his son got into his phone, and he was playing a game. And he managed to rake up a bill of $5,000 playing that game, buying clothes for, I believe, Spider-Man.
Wow.
So you'd buy a suit for Spider-Man, and it would cost $100. And so he was really happy because he contacted Apple and they lowered his bill with 90%. But to me, even at kind of $500, kind of, you shouldn't be able to spend those kind of money so easily. And you can say, hey, you should have locked your phone or whatever. But I really think it's kind of a question of the reasonableness of the applications of what they put in. And in this case, a game that was particularly made for kids, and it was very easy to spend an awful lot of money in the game. So that's an example. It isn't, in this case, a privacy issue, but privacy is a second problem. And I really think that through the app stores, you don't necessarily ensure that the applications don't do anything bad, right?
And that's a really good point, because the Digital Markets Act is the thing in Europe now. Technically, I don't know if this will apply in the UK because we're no longer part of the EU. But the DMA is what is going to force Apple to allow sideloading of apps onto iOS. Now, for me, there are always security concerns with sideloading, because for everyone who knows what we're doing, there is the person who's gone and found a random, and this is something we talked about with Zach in a previous episode. There's someone who finds an APK for Android, which is some Spotify for free type app, which isn't. It's got massive privacy issues. But for all of that, what that means, if you allow free access to other app stores and other marketplaces in your device, on your platform, you can then control your marketplace. So Apple, in this case, can say, actually, you know what? We're not the only marketplace on the iPhone anymore. Out of the App Store. And that can't be a bad thing.
I think overall, what you're talking about in my world is called downloading. You do it all the time on your PC, right? Whether you're using Mac or Linux, you'll be able to download those applications. And those applications are I think most people think twice about what they're downloading and where they're downloading it from. Maybe you think that because it's coming from the App Store that it's more trustworthy. Well, again, we've seen quite clearly that that's not necessarily the case. So I think in some ways it may have the opposite impact, that you might be downloading a really bad application from the App Store that you would never, ever have dreamt of downloading from somewhere else. But you download it from the App Store because you think it's going to be safe. The reality is, again, there's plenty of really bad applications from the App Store, and I really don't like the word sideloading because it's kind of sounding like you have something on the side and that you're doing something wrong. It's called downloading. It's something that everyone has been doing for a long time, and I really think that if you're basing your security on only ensuring that you're installing applications from a trusted source and then you don't have any other means of securing your machine, then you have a problem. You need to have to be looking at the applications, and I think that's what you expect to do in any kind of environment, a computer environment, that you follow the applications and you look at if they're doing something silly. You'll basically then update list with applications that are doing something silly and should be uninstalled, and then you'll recognize them the next time. I mean, it's the battle between the kind of virus handling and the like. So I don't really think it goes away. And again, we've seen with these applications, sometimes it's even applications that have been fine for years, and they get new owners, and the new owners change them, and suddenly they're doing something else than what you'd expect.
WhatsApp being a great example of that. When it was owned by Brian Acton and I've forgotten the other gentleman's name, but when it was not part of Meta, it was great. Mm. But why do you think Brian Acton made such a significant donation to the Signal Foundation? Because, again, Signal doesn't have those problems. One thing I just wanted to touch on quickly, because we've talked about, and you mentioned very early on about cross-platform, is one thing I wanted to highlight about Vivaldi is it is on Mac, Windows, Linux, iOS and Android now, I believe. And we'll touch on some. In fact, actually, let's we've got something to talk about towards the end, but you talked about how the DMA is also why we need to, as a part of that, and why it's going to extend to us, being able to regulate or just outright ban user profiling. Now, what do you mean by user profiling? Are we talking tracking? Because we're not talking about, like, for example, our Vivaldi Sync accounts. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about tracking people across the internet. Is that
Yep. So basically, I mean, I really think, I mean, the intention of something like the GDPR and the like was, I think, good. The problem is you just get all these warnings everywhere and you have no idea what you're dealing with. I really think it should be at a different level. I think there are certain things that should be allowed because it's not really all that harmful. So if a site is having some information about you, what you've been doing, that as long as they're not sharing it with anyone else, it's all good, right? But if you're sharing it with everyone else and if you're building a profile that is then used for marketing, I think that's highly destructive. And I really think that the last 10 years have been a good example of that. I think the reason why we see a fair amount of division and the like is partly because of these extrapolation, I mean, basically the algorithms that are being used on our profiles. So if we didn't have those personalization and these profiles, I think the web would be better. And again, I've been on the web since the very beginning. The timeline we are talking about here is the last 10, 15 years. That's kind of when things changed and personal ads replaced contextual ads. And I really think that's a fundamental change in very many ways, because when you had contextual ads, you were going to a tech site and you saw tech ads. You didn't see random ads. You saw relevant ads to the content you're viewing, typically, right? It wasn't random. It was based on the content, which kind of makes sense. Instead, it would be something like, okay, you visit a tech site, and for the next 2 weeks, you'll see ads for tech everywhere you go. And maybe that's not relevant for you. So I just think that we have a problem here, and I think the only real way is to regulate the use of data. I'm not saying you can't use any data. I think it's kind of like, okay, we can agree that having traffic information is useful, for example, but that doesn't give, because you need the traffic information, doesn't mean that you should be able to use your personal driving patterns as an input to an algorithm to decide what kind of ads you should get. So there's unrelated things. And I think just because companies have had access to data, they've thought they can use it for other things. I mean, going as far as to actually reading your email.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay, you want to recognize that, yes, you just booked a flight to Bermuda and now you're going to be seeing ads for it. Or even worse, you booked a flight to, say, Thailand and now you're seeing Thai ads. And they can be at times then interesting, because just because you're going to Thailand doesn't mean that you're whatever. So I really think that those things are personal. You don't expect your mail company to read your mail. You don't expect your postman to read your mail. You don't expect your phone company to listen to your calls. So why should it, just because it's digital and online, give you the right to kind of access the information and build profile? As a company, if you're hosting mail, you keep your users' data safe. I mean, that's kind of what you should be doing. And I mean, in a lot of cases, if you're an internet company, you will have access to user data potentially. And it's normal, but you keep it safe and you don't use it to build profiles. And so we've been pushing for this. We built a site with the Icelandic Consumer Association, bandspying.org. We let the cats show you why this is bad. And hopefully people will look at that and learn something.
Like, for instance, at one of my last jobs, one of the tools, we had an email marketing program, MailChimp. And MailChimp had a functionality that we didn't use because it just seemed a little too icky. You could connect your mailing list subscribers to their Facebook accounts via their email. Then you could take that and put into Facebook ads and specifically target them by email. And that just felt a little too across domains, and that people who sent it for the email did not consent to us
getting to their Facebook profile. Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, if you look at it further, and I'd like to kind of explain how far this goes a little bit. So, okay, let's say you go on site and you look at something. For some site, you look at, again, some tech gadget or something. You then go into the store, and inside the store, they're using Bluetooth beacons, a technology developed by Apple and Google more or less at the same time. That will track what you're doing inside the store. So they will have a look. They will see, okay, you actually looked at that gadget in the store as well. then you went to a third-party store and then you bought it. Your bank will then share that information of what you bought with whoever, Facebook including. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg said, yeah, we buy data like everyone else, including from the banks. So from that perspective, the amount of data that is collecting is crazy. And I remember there's a Norwegian company I was looking at, and they're doing kind of this Bluetooth beacon data collection. And like they framed it, they're solving the problem that we don't know about as much what you're doing in real life as online. And I'm thinking, okay, there's a problem here. It's the other way around, right? You're supposed to have more privacy. And it isn't necessarily, it's kind of a lot of people say, hey, I don't mind if people know what I'm doing. I have nothing to hide. But I really think that's unfair. And I also think it's a question of where we want to go as a society, because part of the problem isn't necessarily always the individual, but it's, as a society, are we being scrutinized, put into groups, then being given special propaganda for you, my friend? And I think that's really unfortunate and something that we don't want. And we need to basically stop the machine in this case. And the sooner we do it, the better. But I think it's one of those things that people are, hey, these companies are making a lot of money. And that's it's stopping them would shave off a lot of kind of valuations and the like. But the reality for me is that if you look at it, there were winners and losers in this transformation. And there will be winners and losers in the transformation going back. But I think a lot of the winners are the wrong lot, right? In the first round. Because what you saw, for example, is that advertising on content on the internet became a lot harder. Because you could buy, instead of saying, okay, because you're on this podcast or this site, you are an interesting kind of, I want to advertise there because I get the right audience. Instead, you'll just say, hey, that guy saw that site, saw that podcast. Now we can follow him wherever he goes. And we kind of utilize the fact that he is watching this content and advertise towards him. So it's which may actually give revenues then to third parties that are making up content. And the like, which is kind of what you're seeing if you're going into something like Facebook or the like. You won't see a lot of necessarily quality publishers, but you'll see a lot of fake ones.
Yes. And Jay just made a really good point to message me and said, we should talk about AI, because for me, when you were talking about Google reading our emails through Gmail. Now, obviously, we talk about private email. I think it's worth giving a shout out to our friends over at Fastmail, because Fastmail do a great job of keeping your data safe. And we'll put a link in the show notes. We did chat, was it last year, Jay, to Helen Horseman Allen from Fastmail to talk all about why she believes privacy is so important in email. So do go and check that episode out. But when a lot of this, oh, let's read your emails, let's do this, it's for the term that's becoming the buzzword for AI. Now, AI scares me in terms of what it's doing with our content, because AI is not necessarily anything more than a large language model, than a model of data supping up more information about you to help you. What without getting too deep into the weeds, do you think there is an element where, did you say something about AI tabs, Jay?
Yeah, Google Chrome is adding AI tabs to help you organize your tabs better.
So am I understanding this correctly then? But what Google are saying is, we'll analyze what you've been doing on the web, so we know everything you've been doing, and we'll pop up or organize your tabs based on what we think you've been doing.
And suggest sites that we think you might like to visit as well.
One thing I'll agree with you, by the way, on Fastmail. A little bit of a story here, by the way. We actually purchased, when I was at Opera, Fastmail.
Oh.
And then luckily, after I left Fastmail, they bought it back. So I'm really happy that, I know these guys. I think it's a great company. So I would personally vouch for them as well. I like these guys. But going forward to the AI thing, yeah, I mean, I think with AI, it's a question of how are you using the data and what are you doing. I mean, if you're using AI to kind of recognize patterns and fix things like cancer, I'm all for it.
Yes.
If you're utilizing it as another next step of writing algorithms to build profiles on us, hell no. That's not what we need, right? So it's a question of using it. I mean, I can see useful use of the technology. I mean, we're using underlying AI technology with building translation. We have translation built into Vivaldi, which we run on our own servers. We're working with a third-party company. We build ready-made models, so it's not utilizing what you're writing. It's the models are ready-made, right? So we don't get the benefit of improving the models over time, except that we just build new models from other data. So it's a different kind, because I really think that going into the personalization is difficult. And also see, again, we're all been playing with AI and we're laughing at, oh, it's so wrong. And it comes up with answers that sound so right. And then they're so wrong. And that's terrible, right? It's kind of like where I'm seeing a big change gradually is the quality of my spam, right? My spam now is written in localized language, actually spoofing localized companies, and it sounds a lot better. And I think that's terrible. I mean, it's much more likely that you'll fall for it if you're in a minority kind of country and you're someone is writing to you in your language. It sounds a lot more plausible, right? And they're writing almost flawless. And so all the scams and the spam and the like is improved. So far, just like we saw with big data and the like, we are seeing a lot of the negatives. And I'm really hoping that we'll see some positives and that we'll rather regulate the negatives. The problem is that in a situation, and this is what we've seen before with the big data and the like, and I think even more with AI, there are companies there that are finding that their livelihood is threatened, that winning the AI is extremely important. It's companies like Google and Microsoft and the like that are seeing Microsoft thinking, hey, this is an opportunity for us to take the lead. We can be the evil empire again. except that if you search for the term evil empire in the Bing chat, you may not get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, which is the typical thing that happens when you're controlling the answers to questions. But these companies, if they feel threatened, then it's always a question. They are doing it so we can do it. It's the greatest excuse of all for cutting corners to making the wrong decisions. And I don't trust these companies to do the right thing. I think they've proven that they don't. I mean, a lot of the things, they should never have been profiling us in the way. It should have been a wake-up call a long time ago that it's wrong. And I think they're now going to other levels of this. And I'm hoping there will be regulation, because I don't think they'll regulate themselves. And I don't think people necessarily recognize, and they won't necessarily all make the choices to move to something else. And so, and even if a number of them did, it's kind of like, I sometimes see it like I'm in a zombie movie, right?
Mm.
So if you think you're in a zombie movie and you're locked in that kind of typical, the early stage zombie movies, you're locked in that supermarket with a handful of your friends. But the reality, all your other friends are now zombies, and that's a problem. And I see a problem, again, if we are letting the impact of the collection happen. So even if a few of us stay out on the outside, I mean, that's good that some people survive, but you want everyone to survive, and you don't want anyone to be picked on, and you just don't want the misuse of the data, right?
Could not agree more. And it's why I know that they are the same thing, but when I look at things like on-device processing, I tend to prefer the term machine learning. I know that it is the same thing. I understand that. But when I look at, and I know Apple are not perfect. I really know that. I know they've done a lot of their own stuff that is not great. But I like the way that they're not going as far straight away into a generative AI that's off device. Everything Apple seem to have done with the neural engine is on device. And you know, there's tools we use that are on device processing for you know, obviously translation or transcription rather. We're looking to how we do transcripts for these shows. Well, one of the tools we have is an on device model for doing that. And it's to me, as you said, using models like that and using processing, neural processing to cure cancer, to find problems with disease, to all that positive stuff, it is getting outweighed by the negative. Now, looping back to, and probably as our final thought, looping back to something positive, I always say we'd like to talk about cool things on this show. Now, Jay, you're the driver, right? You drive a car. I don't because of my eyesight. Have you ever pondered that when you're parked up, you know, waiting, maybe, for example, you are waiting, you know, we're having a chat while you're waiting to go to work on a Sunday because of a gap, and, you know, you might want to, you know, check our podcast stats, but you don't want to pull your phone out. Instead, you want it on your car. Now, John, Vivaldian cars, I mean, that's not a real thing, surely.
Of course it is. I mean, and I mean, it's been for a little while. We started working on this 2.5 years ago. We got a request from Polestar. They were interested. They were the first cars to kind of having this Android automotive solutions. And they were interested in having a browser, and Google wouldn't give it to them. So they asked, okay, can you help us with that? And I said, yeah, sure we can. So we provided the browser. And since then, it's been kind of growing. So we had the Polestar. You can now get us in some Renault cars as well. And then Volvo. And then there's like Mercedes and then Audi. And now we just announced with we've announced with the Volkswagen Group that you'll be able to download our browser and the like. And then we just announced Lincoln Co. And then with Ford and Lincoln in the U.S., so we're gradually getting availability in cars. And I can tell you it's a great thing to have. I mean, it all depends on your use, right? So in my case, it was a question of, for example, I drove my wife and daughter to the theater. And this time I was not going with them. So I just waited outside and I watched a game of basketball while I did that. So, I mean, I think it was live and I could watch the game like that. I can connect a keyboard, so I can work on the slightly bigger screen, and actually, I can type a lot faster on the keyboard. I connected a kind of a mechanical small keyboard to the car, and I could type. And you have a touch screen, and obviously, if you have a browser like Vivaldi, there you can connect to your, you can do remote logins. Which means you can do any kind of work anywhere. And the sound quality in the cars is pretty good.
Mm.
So the combination of those, I could see you gaming there for real, right? So all of those things, I think for me, the discussion on cars, because a lot of people are saying, well, I don't want browsers in cars. I remember that being said before. It was said about mobile phones. I go so far back when people were saying, you don't want to browse the internet on the mobile. You want to use WAP.
and
WAP was basically a very limited kind of, okay, you go there and check the scores and you check the stocks and latest news and that's it. And the latest news would be 3 sentences per news. Because the idea was you would never do anything else. But our thinking from the very beginning, the web is adaptable. It adapts to your device. We, as a browser maker, need to make that the best possible experience. And with Opera, we did a job there early on by putting a full browser in, because I told you, we were memory safe. We could run on anything. And then we did a client server solution, which did the heavy lifting on the server side, right? And just to be very clear, that meant potentially we could have a lot of information on users. We never used it. We used it for one thing, and that was to make statistics on what people were doing on the internet to prove the point that they actually wanted to use the internet.
But it wasn't being sold to ad companies. It wasn't going outside of Opera.
We made a small report that said, okay, people are mostly using social media in this country, while in another country they were more using videos, and in a third country they were more doing sports. and these are the top sites in the different countries. I mean, there's nothing sensitive in that information whatsoever. It was kind of like, I mean, some people would have sold these reports for fortunes. We were just wanting to say, hey, this is where the world is heading. And yes, if you try to think about it, for a lot of people, mobile was the only way to access the internet. So if you're thinking about that, why would they not like to access the same things that you're accessing on your PC? What's the logic of that? Now, things have changed a little bit, and we've got apps that are trying to basically keep you engaged and not do browsing. But at the time, that wasn't kind of it wasn't the case. And I still think a lot of people just want to browse the internet. I think the browser is still the most important application that you'll find on your computer or mobile.
Absolutely. And I remember Opera Mini being very much a selling point on, you know, on, shall we say, feature phones.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would run on anything. I mean, that was the point for us. It could run on a phone with a tiny screen, and it would display pages as if they were local. It would do it in seconds instead of minutes. And it would compress the data 95% on average.
Which is impressive. Yeah.
I used it on my Windows mobile phone.
Yep. No, it was. I mean, at the time when we were building Opera on mobile, I mean, we had like 80% markets here in places like Africa, India, and the like. And this is where I felt, okay, we are making a difference here because we are helping people. Where the kind of the PC penetration was low single digits, but everyone had a mobile phone, and now they could all access the internet. Which, by the way, one of the reasons why I'm kind of pissed off about kind of all this profiling and the like. I've been working all my life to get people online in the best possible way for them, thinking that it's actually good for society that people have equal access to information. Not in my wildest dreams was I thinking that someone thought it would be okay then to profile people to generate algorithms to make them hate each other. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no, it's not what... I can't imagine it's what Sir Tim Berners-Lee thought would happen when he created that first website and web server.
Yep, yeah. He created the standards, he created the first browser, the first server, and obviously, I mean, for him, I think, I mean, we share the same opinions on this, and this idea of creating this data collection or the like, I mean, it's just wrong, and I think we need to get back on the straight and narrow. I think we can do that,
yeah.
And we have to just fight for that. I think we fought a heavy fight against the, kind of the closed internet solutions, against Microsoft and the MSNs and the like, and the web won, and I think the web can win again. And part of what I'm excited about is the Fediverse and kind of the concept of the distributed web, not Web 3. Web 3 is a scam, but the real kind of distributed kind of web standards, Fediverse-based technical solutions, that's interesting because, again, multiple servers is kind of like the web. So you can host your own kind of localized servers, but you can still access all the others, kind of like email, kind of like the web. I think it's very promising. And obviously, the standards here are written by W3C, so the World Wide Web Consortium, which is how it's supposed to be. I mean, for me, again, that continues to be the gold standard of specification. I'm still hoping more and more organizations will be signing up, that basically they will see, okay, this idea of being on social networks, where I think in a way what's happening with Twitter is a great example of that. How far it can go and how damaging it can be. And so hopefully people will learn from that and support a distributed system, which I think is a lot better in also many ways.
Absolutely. Well, John, look, this has been a genuinely interesting discussion. I really, really want to say thank you for being so open about Vivaldi, for sharing some amazing insights about the past, the present, and the future of where we are with our browsers. This is definitely another one of those episodes, folks, where we really want to hear from you. So listen to the outro, but head over to our Discord server, crosswise.net/Discord. Come and have a discussion. If you're not on Discord, you don't want to be, fine. We are obviously on Mastodon. You could drop us an email podcast@crosswires.net. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Maybe you've got some memories of older browsers. Maybe you were a web developer back in the day and you had to battle the challenges of making your site compatible with all those different browsers. Before we wrap up, Jay, any closing thoughts from yourself?
I like the fact that we are bringing back the ideas and because like I remember getting all my friends signed for Opera back when the Opera was providing the you could get it for free for getting all your friends to sign up for it. And I remember being so excited to get a free Opera. And I just want to say, because I loved the ethos of Opera. And I'm so glad you're bringing back that ethos through Vivaldi and just the focus, again, on privacy. And I just want to say one thing we didn't mention, but it's just really cool, is the Vivaldi Social. That is really cool to see how much you are engaged in the Fediverse. And, just want to say, John, thank you so much for coming on and talking about it. And yeah, I think the future can be scary in some regards, but it's also exciting knowing that there are people who want to bring back the web and make the web a better place.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. I think for me, I mean, that is the focus. We it's a little bit of a battle. We have to fight for it, but I think there's a lot of opportunity to do so, and we have to do our best to move the web into the right direction again.
Absolutely. So, John, where can people find out more about Vivaldi and maybe yourself as well?
Basically, Vivaldi.com. And like you said, I mean, you can go on Vivaldi Social. I'm being kind of active there as well. I mean, I am in other places, but probably more so on Vivaldi Social, which is part of the Mastodon and the Fediverse. So you can find us from any of the Mastodon servers or the Fediverse servers out there. So, yep, that's where I'm hanging. And you can read all about us on Vivaldi.com and download and try, and whether you're going to try it in your computer or car or mobile or whatever else we will support in the future.
Or your Steam Deck, because that is honestly a great little browser to use on the Steam Deck. It's so it's so nice to not have a Google owned browser on the Steam Deck and on Linux. I mean, I wish I had it on my work laptop, but I've got it on my little test ThinkPad running Pop OS. So thank you for making it so accessible. Folks, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. We'll play the outro. Thanks for listening to this episode of Crosswires. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion and we'd love to hear your thoughts. So please drop us a note over to podcast@crosswires.net. Why not come and join our Discord community over at crosswires.net/Discord. We've got lots of text channels, we've even got voice channels, and we've got forum posts for every episode that we put out there. If you're a Mastodon, you can also follow us either by heading over to wires.social or just follow crossed@wires.social.
If you'd like to check out more of our content, head on over to crossedwires.net/YouTube for all our videos, and keep an eye on our Twitch channel at crossedwires.net/live for our upcoming streams.
If you like what you heard, please do drop a review in your podcast directory of choice. It really does help spread the word about the show.
And of course, if you can spare even the smallest amount of financial support, we'd be incredibly grateful. And you can support us at ko-fi.com/crossedwires. That is ko-fi.com/crossedwires.
Until next time, thanks for listening.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.